Hello and welcome to our series of podcasts for Equine Health Week 2026 in partnership with Agria. Now, our topic today is one that strikes fear into the hearts of many horse owners with very good reason. Colic is one of the most common veterinary emergencies that we encounter and one of the highest causes of equine death worldwide. While the severity and causes of colic will vary, knowing how to spot the signs so you can respond quickly is vital in giving your horse the best chance of a good outcome. And that's something we are going to discuss in today's episode, as well as how you can manage the risk factors associated with colic to reduce the likelihood of it happening in the first place. Joining me to discuss this today is Sarah Freeman, who is Professor of Veterinary Surgery at the University of Nottingham after joining their School of Veterinary Medicine and Science in 2005. Sarah combines teaching across all years of the curriculum with clinical research, including leading the Nottingham Equine Colic Research Team, which this year is celebrating a decade since the launch of its React Colic campaign. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
We are delighted to have you here. Now, we should probably kick off. What actually is colic? Because it's more of a sort of umbrella term for a number of different things, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. So the term colic actually just refers to the signs that the horse is showing, and those are signs of abdominal pain. And that means anything within the horse's abdomen. And most of those are gastrointestinal, which is what we tend to think of as colic, but it can also be caused by other organs within the abdomen. So, for example, kidneys or spleen or liver or bladder problems. So they're less common, but they can be. And then the intestinal stuff can be anywhere from the stomach all through the small intestine, large intestine, and all the way down to sort of the colon and the rectum, which is why it's quite a challenging condition to deal with.
Absolutely. As you say, so much going on there. And then what are some of the risk factors or maybe the underlying causes that might mean a horse is predisposed to having an episode of colic, wherever in that system it happens to be?
So when we look mainly at the intestinal causes of colic, because that's where we've got most of the information about risk factors, there are lots of different risk factors because there are lots of different diseases that can cause colic. And there may be some that are specific to different types of horse or different types of colic. The one that comes up very consistently is management change, and that is across multiple different causes of colic. And that's because the way the horse evolved is they would be eating small amounts of food continuously and their environment wouldn't change dramatically. And if we do anything to change it drastically, like moving them from a full grass diet to shutting them in the box when it's very wet weather, then we change all of those systems very quickly. And management change, be that exercise, traveling, feed types, that is the biggest factor that causes colic, and also the biggest factor that we can control and change as well.
So say that though, you may end up with colic as almost a sort of a secondary problem to something else. So like, say for instance, your horse has for whatever reason had to go on box rest, then that colic risk is going to increase.
Yes, yeah, and it's quite common to get impactions where there is food that has slowed down and become very dry in the intestine with horses on box rest. It's a very kind of typical history because they've come off grass and they're walking around and they're eating quite a wet diet, and then all of a sudden they are painful on box rest, not walking around, and completely changed their diet. And it's that sudden change that is problematic and can lead to problems.
So, and I guess as well, this is where, well, we'll come on to the signs and the symptoms and things at the moment, but having a very good baseline, which is something we've talked about across this week, having a baseline of what's normal for your horse is going to be really helpful, particularly if those changes in management are happening.
Yes, yeah. So having a baseline, knowing what's normal for your horse, and if the routine changes for any reason, trying to get back a little bit towards that. So if they have to come off grass and have to be on box rest, then giving them wetter feed that is more like their grass, or picking them some grass, skin some grass if you're allowed to walk them out, or even have them in a bigger stable so that they're moving, all of those things that reduce that change. But knowing your horse in those cases is really, really important. So picking up, you know, the early signs that things are going wrong, you've got a much better chance of stopping them or making it the problem less severe as well.
And what then are those signs that we should be looking for? Because I imagine they're going to range in terms of sort of some are going to be quite subtle and some might be very, very obvious.
Yes, yeah. So we'll talk about the more obvious ones, which are the sort of classic text ones, textbooks ones, in a minute. But the very early ones are often just changes in how much they're eating or how quickly they're eating and changing in their droppings. So if your horse is off its food a little bit and it's not passing as many droppings and they're dry, then you need to be aware of that and you need to be on that and thinking about why that's happening and what you can do to reduce it. And a lot of even the more severe ones, owners will often say, oh, well, actually, he's not been right for the last few days or the last week. And so the better we can be at picking up those early signs is really important. The horse that's a bit quieter, the horse that doesn't want to come out and interact with the others, again, are some of those early signs. And then you move on to the more sort of classical signs, which are pawing the ground, flank watching, rolling, box walking. Those are the ones we tend to recognize more commonly. And some of the more severe colics can go straight into those ones. But if you get the chance and see those early signs, that's really, really important, that changes in eatings and droppings, because often you can head off or pick things up much, much earlier.
And if you're then seeing those signs, what should you be doing? What should the process you should follow?
The first thing to do is just to think about your individual horse, what has happened, has anything changed, and also how comfortable you feel on managing. And we would always encourage just to phone for help. And whether that is your yard manager first or somebody you know who's more experienced, if your horse is showing severe signs of colic, go straight for the vet. If you're not sure, you can phone your yard manager first and then your vet. Or just phone your vet, because the vets won't charge you for a phone call and some advice down the phone, and they can then give you some advice on whether or not that needs to be seen. And as a vet, what we see is the earlier we can see these cases, the easier they are to treat. And if they have the more severe one, then the better the chances of survival. So if in any doubt, just pick up the phone. And if you can't get information from your yard owner immediately, then just go straight for your vet. And there's always a vet on call somewhere, some hour of the day as well.
Yeah, as you say, getting it early, even if it is that you've called them out and it turns out to be a bit less severe, is a far better option than leaving it a bit too long, and then by the time they do get there, you know, you've got to go for the more sort of drastic end of treatment, which again we'll come to in a minute. So you've got your horse, he's showing the signs of colic, and you phone the vet. What steps should you take in that period between making that phone call and the vet actually arriving? Because again, we've talked about how doing things as quickly as possible, reacting as quickly as possible, is key with this.
Yeah, so the first thing you want to think about is safety, and that is your safety and the horse's safety. There is a common misconception that you have to walk horses when they've got colic, and you absolutely don't. There are a small number of conditions where exercising them can be beneficial, but that doesn't apply to all of them, and you often don't know until the vet has seen them and made the diagnosis. And there's also a misconception that if you allow them to roll, they will get a twisted gut, and that also isn't true. They're usually rolling because they have got a twisted gut. And so we discourage people from exercising them and keeping the horse up and stopping it from rolling. If it's uncomfortable, just like when we've got bellyache, let them lie in whatever position they want to, and make that environment safe for them. So if they're in the stable, take out your pitchforks and your brooms and the water buckets, take out any food, put a nice bedding down so that they're safe, and then make sure that you are safe as well. So we also see people trying to do heroic things in keeping horses up. Well, the horse just wants to lie down and the person is going to get injured. So if it's not safe, you should step outside of the stable. And then what you can do while you're waiting for your vet, because you tend to feel a bit helpless, what am I doing, is just make a note of what signs your horse is showing and how often they're showing them. And that will be really helpful for when the vet comes. And if you don't have a stable, then we also say put them on a long lunge line so they can get down and they can roll somewhere safe in a menage or somewhere in the big field. But your horse's safety and your safety is really important.
Okay, so the vet's now arrived. We've done all these things. The vet is on site. What are they going to do in terms of making sure that horse is made comfortable and hopefully resolving what's happening?
So the order in which they do things will depend on the severity. So the really severe cases, the vet will pretty much be straight in. They're trying to give some painkillers or some sedation and calm things down, and they will do an examination, and then they'll also ask you for some information. And like I say, if it's a mild case, they might start asking you for some information or it's a severe case, they might go straight in and give some drugs so that the horse is calm and quiet. The information they will ask you, and it's important that you know this, is around those management change things that we talked about. So trying to find out what's actually triggered this and what might be the potential cause. They'll also want to know things around your vaccination, your worming policy, what's been going on with any other horses. And they may also ask about your insurance and your finances, so that they're making sure that they are doing a treatment plan that is tailored for what you and your horse are able to manage, both financially and in terms of sort of what you can physically manage on your yard as well. So lots of questions and lots of things to think about. So it can be quite useful, again, when you're waiting for your vet, to think about those. So when did I last worm my horse? What did I worm them? Have they had colic before? Those kind of things as well. Vet will then do a physical examination. That's really, really important. Tells us an awful lot of information and is really useful. Things like the heart rate and the colour of the mucous membranes, the gums, are really good indicators, that and the level of pain, of how serious something is. And your vet will have to do some other tests as well. And listening to the gut sounds is also really helpful. But those are probably some of the key indicators. So we did a study a few years ago looking at 1,000 horses that vets saw in practice. And what were the things that told them on that first examination about whether that horse was going to be critical, so need intensive care or surgery or potentially being euthanized. And it was heart rate, gum color and gut sounds. So really simple things, and that clinical exam is really, really important. And then the vet is very likely to do some further tests. And one of the challenges that we have is if you went in with bellyache, somebody would palpate, put your fingers on and press on your abdomen. But the horse's belly is so big, we can't do that from the outside and we can't get any information. So the majority of cases will need a rectal examination, so the vet can actually put their hand inside and have a feel and an idea of what's going on. And although it seems a little bit invasive, it's really, really important because we don't know, and it will often change what we do in terms of our treatment. So I talked about impactions before. You can feel most of those on rectal examination. Some of the severe cases, we will feel things that tell us that they're surgical. So a really important one. And then the next thing they may do is to pass a stomach tube. And again, it's not very pleasant for the horse, but really, really essential. And that's because the horse can't vomit, it can't be sick. So when it gets a buildup of fluid in its intestines, they back up to the stomach and the stomach gets bigger and bigger and bigger, incredibly painful. And if that's not relieved by passing the stomach tube, it can actually go on and rupture. So it's not a very nice procedure. Horses don't like it and they sometimes have nosebleeds, but it can be potentially life-saving, a really, really important procedure to do. And then there may be some other tests based on what they find from those ones. So the next ones would be things like taking a blood sample, doing an ultrasound, getting a sample of fluid from the belly. So a variety of things depending on those first fundamental things, the physical examination and the rectal and the stomach tube.
And I guess because your vet is going to be doing all these tests, it's very important that in that period where you're waiting them to arrive, you don't give the horse something like, say, a tube of Sedlin that you've got in your first aid kit or something like that that might impact the things that they're looking for to make that important diagnosis.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So yes, if you give them any sedative, it changes their heart rate, which means we then can't use that as an indicator of the prognosis. And if you happen to have a sachet of Butyrand and give that, then actually that's really unhelpful because that won't kick in for a few hours if you give it by mouth, but then the vet can't give the intravenous injection they were going to give, and you've also changed the pain. So it limits what the vet can then do. So they can't give immediate pain relief because your sachet of Bute is going to kick in 4 hours time. So yeah, people think they're being helpful by doing that, and actually it can actually be detrimental to what we can actually give the horse and the horse's welfare as well.
Yeah, I think that's the case. It can be a very distressing time to see your horse in pain and have these symptoms, and you kind of just have to grin and bear it and do the few things the vet said you can do in order for that long-term outcome to be as good as it can be. Okay, so your vet's done the test and they've kind of figured out what the problem is. If it's something sort of like, say, well, you know, a spasmodic colic or something that's quite minor, what are they then going to be doing in terms of treating that horse and hopefully leaving them happy and comfortable in their stable?
So the good news is the majority of cases are the minor ones and the mild ones. And a large proportion of colics, we actually never know what caused them. So they might be some trapped wind that we can't feel. They might be a gut spasm, and we call them idiopathic. And that is the most common cause of colic. The most common cause of colic is we don't know what it was. but we gave it either something to reduce the gut spasm or some painkillers, and they get better. So that pretty much all of those get better with a single injection. The next most common ones are the gas entrapment. And again, most of those, the very large majority of those, will get better again, just with either some painkillers or some gut spasms. The next most common is the impactions, that feed impaction, and they will need some painkillers, but they'll also often need some fluids given by stomach tube to shift everything and going and get them moving. So most of them are relatively simple. So the majority of cases are what we call mild medical and will resolve with a single treatment. Some of those mild ones might need a second treatment, a second lot of fluids, for example, for an impaction. And then a much smaller percentage are the ones that are more difficult to treat and might need that horse to be referred. And those are either if the horse has got a severe diarrhea and needs some fluid therapy, or whether they have the gut is displaced or twisted and they either need a prolonged period of fluids and starving, or if the gut is twisted and dying, then they'll need surgery. So those are the ones that everybody's worried about, but they are the minority of cases, is the good news.
Yes, absolutely. Because I think that's the thing, people hear colic and think colic surgery. But as you say, it is only a very minor portion of the sufferers that are going to have something like that.
Yeah.
Albeit the ones that do, it can be quite a serious process with, I'm assuming, quite a long recovery period as well.
Yes. And those critical ones, what is really important is that you get on top of them really quickly, because if the gut twists and dies, you have a very, very short period of time where you can actually untwist it and don't even need to cut anything out. And those have the best chance of coming through surgery. And if you do have to cut anything out, then the shorter the period of time that gut is dying and the bacteria releasing toxins into the system, then the better the chance of survival is. So those are the ones, if you're ever in any doubt, just phone your vet and they'll make the decision. And if they look severe, just everything has to go really, really fast, and that means calling the vet fast, making your decisions fast, knowing what you're going to do, so you're not waiting and delaying for that. And then you talked about how long it takes to recover. So most horses would be on box rest for at least a month. If everything goes well, box rest for a month, small paddock for a month, hand walking for a month. So 3 months is probably the minimum period of time before they start coming back into work. But the really good news, and again, it's a kind of misconception that people have, is that they can go back to full work. And there are several studies now that have shown horses that have gone back to the same level or a higher level of performance and at a very high level. So racing at the and doing extremely well, racing, top level show jumping, five-star eventing. There are all horses in these disciplines who have successfully come through colic surgery. So if people are prepared and they think it's right for them and their horse and can invest the time and the money, then those horses can go back to doing extremely well.
And I guess that, I think that's a really good point you made there about considering the time, the effort that will go into that period. And I think it's probably something that we all need to have at the back of our heads as part of maybe an emergency care plan for a horse or something like that. Is that something that you are willing to A, put your horse through, B, are you able to put your horse through it, and are you C, also able to do all that aftercare to get them back to that point where they can be returning to the life they had before?
Yeah, and all of those things are really important. You might not be able to afford it. You might not think it's the right thing for your horse. You might not have the facilities, or your horse might not tolerate box rest. So every time I go away on holiday, I give a list of my horses to one of my vet friends and say, I want you to decision make for these, but this is how much I will spend on each of these horses, and these are the procedures I want done, and these are the procedures I don't want done. And I've had some of these horses for a long period of time, and unfortunately, the things that I would have had done when they were 12, I wouldn't have had done when they are 20. So thinking about that and keeping that update list is really important. And it also means if you have to make those decisions, you are not going to be delaying, which is going to impact your horse's welfare. You are either, yes, I'm going for this, or no, I can't do this. And then you are very clear on your pathway, and there is no waiting and waiting and waiting while you think about it and your horse is lying there colicking. I think that emergency plan is so, so important.
Yeah. And I think as well, the point you made there about having a decision maker as well, if for whatever reason you are not contactable, you're on holiday, you've gone somewhere, even they just can't get hold of you on the phone for whatever reason, that there is someone who if push comes to shove, could make that decision for your horse, even if it is simple as having the vet come in and being there to help make those decisions at the initial stage, I think is so important when time is such a key factor in all of this.
Yeah, and the right person as a decision maker. Mm. So my in-laws look after the farm while I go away, but I wouldn't ask them to make a decision. I tell them to phone the vet, and the vet's got the list of things, because they would find that very, very hard. So it's also who you share those decisions with, and who, that sort of chain of decision making is really important.
Yeah, and the relationship you have with your vet as well, and them knowing your horse is going to be important in that as well. So we talked a little bit with it about at the start about some of those sort of the, when we were talking about the risk factors, we talked about where this comes from. And a lot of that is the change in management things. When it comes to managing our horses, is there anything else we can do to try and reduce that risk in terms of colic and contracting it?
So it's all about routine for horses, and that even things like having a different person looking after that horse increases the risk of colic. So if you have somebody else do it, they need to follow your routine. So same time of day, same things. And that can be difficult maybe if you're going away competing, but actually just take your same food with you, just feed them at the same time of day, try and stick to the same routines as much as you can. And we talked before about, you know, horses will have to come in the stable, but they're still trying to follow the same routine. So same routine, following the same management, making sure you're on top of your parasite control, that you have a good worming management. And that doesn't necessarily mean giving the horses worm earth. A lot more of that is now around doing fecal worm egg counts and blood samples and managing the pasture. So that's also really, and becoming increasingly important. The, you know, the worm problem is probably as important, if not more so, than it was a few years ago, as we're losing control of how we are able to worm horses. So being on top of that and knowing your pasture management is really important.
Absolutely. And if that is something that you feel you could learn a little bit more about, make sure you listen back to the episodes we put out in January on worming and parasite control. There's three episodes there. We cover all of this stuff in terms of the management process, and if and when you do need to test, how to go about doing that. And if and when you need to treat and test, we cover both sides of it, and some management stuff as well, and pasture management. So do listen back to those. You can find them wherever it is that you found this episode of the podcast. Just scroll back a few episodes and they are there. So make sure you give them a listen. Very helpful to do that little plug there. And as well, you, I know, Sarah, you recently presented at the National Equine Forum as part of some of the sort of recent advances in diagnosis with horses. And there are some new advances as well in colic detection as well, I understand.
Yeah, so we're working with a company that uses computer vision, so watches videos, monitors your horse, and then sends alerts. And I was following this company for a number of years when they were doing the cattle work and saying, please, please, will you do it for colic for me? And we've started doing that. And that looks really exciting. And I've talked throughout this podcast about the importance of speed and knowing and recognizing stuff. And there's lots of times as vets where we turn up in the morning because that's the first time somebody sees something and that horse has been colicking through the night and it's really sick. And sometimes it's not even an option to refer it because it's so sick. And that is heartbreaking for everybody involved. So for me, this is a massive breakthrough. We are running it in one massive yard, two competition yards, two vet hospitals, and we have a system that detects signs of colic. It's running continuously, sending alerts, and therefore you then know exactly when that horse is colicking, and that is about to become commercially available, but just will be a huge breakthrough. We've got horses that I'm following at the moment, a couple with gastric ulcers, and they show colic for about 15 minutes of the day after feeding, and that's not been identified by anybody. So you imagine 24 hours, there's just one 15 minute period and we're able to pick up those signs of colic. So I think that will be a huge help for horse owners, because there's lots of periods of time when you're not around and nobody is around, and having something that is watching, alerting you and telling you something's happened, go back and watch the video and check what's going on, will be hugely, I think will make a huge difference in terms of what we can do and identify.
Absolutely. Didn't you see as well that there were horses who changed their behavior when someone came into the stable? So they were previously on the camera showing signs of maybe distress or discomfort, and as soon as that person turned up, the behavior changed.
Yes, yeah. So the video I showed was a horse that was colicking, and the staff went down to check it. So before they went, it was pawing the ground, walking around, rolling. As soon as the staff went to check it, the horse jumped up, stood with its head over the door, with its ears forward, watching everything. As soon as they left, it lay down and colicked as well. So we're seeing lots of hidden behaviours. And that wasn't a single case. The hospital footage, we see it over and over again. Anybody walks down the yard, the staff go on morning rounds, the horse jumps up and goes, no, I haven't got colic. My leg doesn't hurt. I'm absolutely fine. And as soon as they leave, or as soon as that person walks away, that horse then starts showing those signs of pain as well. So it's giving us a much better insight and allowing us to pick up things that the horse would be hiding from us. And that hiding behavior is an evolutionary thing. So they've done it to hide from predators in the past so that they don't get in by the lions and the wolves, but they also hide it from their herd mates, because if one of the horses is sick, the rest of the herd may push them out and say, lions, come and eat this one first, because it's easy game rather than us. So it's, you know, even after all of this time, they do hide those behaviors. And so we are seeing, particularly at nighttime, we're seeing lots of behaviors that those horses wouldn't show in the presence of other people, and sometimes in other horses as well.
No, it's really, really interesting. As you said, it's very new science, but it's showing us things that we didn't know before. And information is well, yeah, the more you're informed you are, the more prepared you are, I think is where I was going with that. But yeah, it is so interesting that we're still learning these things. If we've covered sort of quite a bit today, and there's quite a lot of information here, if you could pick one takeaway nugget that someone listening to this should kind of have in their brain, what would it be?
I think it has to be the emergency plan. Think about what would happen. And people don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about, you know, if my horse got colic and it needed surgery to survive, what would I want to do? That's a really uncomfortable thing to think about. But it is so, so important. And you've got to think that actually it does feel uncomfortable doing it, but actually that could save my horse's life. That will change its welfare. And even if your decision is, I don't want surgery and I have my horse euthanized, well, having that decision and making that decision rather than allowing it to colic for minutes is bad, hours is awful. You know, you need to be really clear and know what you're going to do. And that emergency plan will also give you peace of mind that you have made the right decision. You've thought everything through logically when you are logical and rational. It's very hard to make a decision when the horse is lying on the floor in front of you in horrendous pain. Your kind of rational mind, you know, is not working at all. So sitting down and making that emergency plan and sharing that with people is so, so important.
Absolutely. And there are templates available online for people who want to put something like that together. I believe the BHS has one. And I'm sure there are others you can find that will help you make sure you've got the right information there, and who to circulate it to as well. In terms of other resources, what is available out there for people? Because obviously we mentioned right at the start about the REACT campaign, and that's got some great things for people in terms of helping with colic education.
Yeah, so we've got lots of resources through the British Horse Society REACT campaign, and that includes things about different types of colic. There's some videos of me showing you the bits of the intestine and what they all do, and just explaining how things work. There's some videos of horses showing signs of colic. There's some stuff around risk factors preventing colic, what the vet's going to do. So lots of different resources around there as well. There are other great resources and other websites. And one of my favourite ones when you're looking at risk factors is one done by Guelph. I think it's horseportal.com. I know you've got the link coming up. And that has looked at all the different risk factors and plugged them into a little dial. So you enter all the information for your horse and the dial goes up from green to yellow, to amber, to red. And it will tell you whether your horse is subject to a number of risk factors, but also you can think about the things that you can change and then watch that dial drop back down again. So I think that's a really nice one for people who are worried, or horses that have had repeated episodes of colic, because it allows you to say, well, I can do that, but I can't do that. But maybe I can try doing these things, and that will then drop me back out of that red zone into a safer zone.
Absolutely. I had a play with this before we came on to recording for my horse, and it's very good at making you think about all those different risk factors, because it takes you through the various different things you need to think about. And, you know, you watch that dial move a bit. Luckily, my horse stayed in the green, but it does make you think about how many factors I think go into something like colic. And at the end, you can kind of, you feel quite good if you've stayed in the red and stayed in the green. And as Sarah said, it means that if you have gone a little bit further up the dial, you can think about the things that you can change to get yourself back into the green. So I do recommend having a look at that, and we will share the link to that and also to those React resources as well. You will find them on our online hub on our website, britishequestrian.org.uk, where we've got all the stuff that we've shared across this week, and we will also signpost them on our social media as well. So do take a look at those. As we kind of wrap up, Sarah, is there anything else you feel it's worth mentioning or that we might have missed at this point?
I think just going back to the management change thing, there are several studies now that show that the highest risk is within the first 5 days. And I think that's quite useful to know. So if your horse has to come in for anything, then those are the first 5 days where you really need to be trying to change things gradually, but also need to be keeping an extra close eye on your horse. And that's been shown in a couple of studies. We did one a number of years ago and looked at horses, how dry their droppings were, how quickly their intestines were moving. But there's also been some work done the microbiome, and actually very conveniently that is also that 5 days is that risk period. So that's the bacteria in your gut change, in the horse's gut changing. So those, that sort of first week post-management change is really, really important. And I think if you're thinking about changing anything, that's where you want to be trying to do it gradually over that period. So remember, 5 days, gradual change and close monitoring, I think, is helpful as well.
Absolutely. And make sure you listen to the next episode of this podcast we've got coming up, where we do talk about the what you can do in terms of digestion and nutrition to keep that healthy gut biome as well. Our nutrition dream team are back to talk through all of that as well, which, as we've sort of mentioned, this will play a very close relationship in terms of reducing the risk factors for colic on that side of things. So do give that a listen again. You'll find it later today wherever it is that you found this one as well. Thank you so much, Sarah, for giving up your time to speak to us today. It's been a really interesting conversation, particularly I think actually around the new advancements in colic detection. I think it's going to be really interesting to see where all of that goes, and hopefully everyone listening will maybe feel a little bit better, a little bit easier about the thought of colic. As I said at the start, it is a very, very scary thing, and if you have a horse, colic is one of those sort of buzzwords that sets alarms going in your brain. But hopefully by being a little bit more informed, we can hopefully feel a little bit more at ease and prepared for if it does happen to our horses. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you everyone for listening as well. Make sure you check out that web hub that I mentioned earlier for everything we've shared across Equine Health Week. Keep an eye on our social media feeds. We've covered some great topics so far, and there are some more really interesting ones to come. So we hope you will join us again soon. Thank you and goodbye.